tacos. And I checked, no one is having coffee outside, so they all must be where they want to be. And hopefully you want to be listening to economic stories and how we should think about stories that economists and people who pretend to be economists tell us. Once upon a time, there was a professor, not me, but professors trying to introduce themselves with not only what they know, and people like to evaluate what they're hearing based on logic, right? Is he in command of the facts? Then does he put those facts together in a logical way? And then who is he, right? And why should I listen to this person even if he seems to have his facts in order? So introduce myself. These are some of the values that I try to bring to my work and to this lecture. People like labels because they like to know who they're talking to, right? And I understand that. People want to, they'll say, oh, you're an economist, right? Or, oh, you're an environmentalist. Or you're on the left, right? right?
Yeah.
Or one side or the other. And those are labels which are handy, and I have never, and you can ask my wife here, identified myself, unless under duress, as any of those things, okay? I would prefer to identify myself as these things. A Rebbetzin is the rabbi's wife. And there's not a good English word for that. I'm married to Pastor Pam over here, and somebody didn't get the joke the other day and actually wanted to know if she was, in fact, a rabbi. And she is, in fact, not. But I am, in fact, and we could debate whether I'm, in fact, a wife in this relationship. But anyway, I have some children. I try to bring those values to my work, and I try to be a citizen. So these are the values that I think that should inform everyone's work. Not only their professional training, not only where they identify the political spectrum, but these are labels that if you are asked, where are you coming from, so that I can evaluate what you're saying, I would prefer to bring these labels to that. What is a story? We hear a lot of stories, and if you were at the Bible study, I accused Reverend Story of telling stories this morning, and economic stories. And a story begins once upon a time. And is this a story? Once upon a time, a man was rich, and then he was, because he was in the 1% and he was well protected, he was still rich. Is that a story? No? Not a story? Unsatisfying? Okay. Right? What about a man was rich and he had a lot of staff and people were holding up benches and then the bench holder uppers rebelled and then he lost everything. That is a story.
It has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
It has a beginning, a middle, and but so did the first one. A man was rich and he had staff and then he was still rich. Beginning, middle, end.
No tension.
Nothing changes. Okay, so a story, in the simplest terms, there's a beginning point. Then something happens, and usually at the end, to make this interesting story anyway, the beginning point is inverted. You end up the opposite where you started at. Okay? Is an analogy or a metaphor a story? So we heard this morning, the earth is just like the village center. The economy is just like a household or a community. Is that a story?
No, it's a statement.
Okay, it's a statement. Is it related to a story in some way?
It's a device for a story.
How is it a device for storytelling?
Well, it sets the stage. Village center is the earth. It sets the stage of context.
And then something happened. Somebody punched a hole in it and was, okay, very good. We will hear a lot about a nation as a household. It's not quite what Alan was talking about, but it's very similar. Or economic competition is a game. We're going to win and somebody else is going to lose. These are analogies and metaphors that then lead to stories. We were in this game, and then we did something, and then we won versus Japan or versus Greece. Greece lost and was poor as a result. I'm going to tell a little bit of story here, and then we're going to move into the real deal. Once upon a time, there were young urban professionals in Washington, D.C. They worked for the government. They lived on Capitol Hill. They were lawyers. They were policymakers. They were staff to congresspeople. And they had children. Mm. And they worked long hours. They worked very hard. And they needed to go out on dates to have a wife, either to reconnect with their spouse who they never saw, or they wanted to meet somebody and get married and have children. And so they formed the Capitol Hill Babysitting Cooperative. And when we go out on a date, we will take care of your children. And because they were government planners and everything, they systematized the whole thing and they issued script. One piece of paper for, it gave you the right for a night out, and then you would give the piece of paper to somebody else and they would earn a night out. So you would spend a night out and they would earn a night out. And they printed up a bunch of this, and there was a central bank, one of the lawyers, volunteered to run the bank. Maybe it was an economist, I don't know. And everything started out for a while. People were, people went out on dates and they were happy and they were happier than they were before. So far the story's moving along nicely. There was a problem. People couldn't go out on date night. Then they did this thing. They found a central bank and printed some money. And then things got better. It's a pretty good story so far, but it's not the end of the story. After a while, the economy slowed down. People weren't spending money. And somebody wanted to go out on a date, but somebody wanted to babysit to earn money to go on a date, but nobody wanted to go on a date night. It seemed hard to believe because people really wanted to go on date nights. Why weren't they going on date nights? Don't tell me yet. But think about it, okay? Think about why they weren't going on date nights. So everybody got together and said, the economy has slowed down, this is terrible, and we actually have unemployment. People want to babysit, but no one will hire them to babysit. And the lawyers and the planners, we do this all day on the Hill, let's pass a regulation. Everyone has to go out at least once a month. Right? Are you with me? Is this plausible so far? Do you believe that? Okay, right? And then one of the guys, there's always an economist in every crowd, or one of the economists says, I don't know if a regulation is really going to solve anything here. Maybe there's just not enough money in the system. Now, what does that mean? Now you get to say, what does that mean?
Print more script.
Print more. Why?
They'll have that script to spend.
And why aren't they doing it? Everyone has script now. They printed script. And it was equally distributed. It was fair. It was just. There's money out there. Why aren't they spending it? They're saving for the future. Those damn savers. They're screwing the whole thing up. The Presbyterians, they're saving for the future. Okay? Right? And he said, why don't we print more money? And everyone's like, it's crazy to print more money. But we'll give it a try. And they printed more money and handed it out, and the economy took off. People went out on date nights, and people sat for other people, and people were happy, and marriages got better. Okay? End of story. And it's an absolutely true story. Now, what did we do? Did we cut taxes? There were no taxes. Did we educate the workers better so they could be more productive?
No.
Did we cut regulations that were interfering with people's ability to go babysit for other people? There were no regulations. Everybody trusted each other already, okay? You didn't have to take a license. You didn't have to pay a registration fee. They just printed more money. Okay? That's magic. In the beginning, the economy was weak. And then we printed money out of nothing, and then the economy got better. I told this story to my father-in-law, who, if you must have labels, is on the opposite of whatever my label is. He's also a father, a Christian, etc., but that's not always enough. And he said, and for what it's worth, he doesn't believe in my economics, okay? As far as I can tell. He said, that makes total sense to me. Okay? So we have a story, And we, now I'm going to try and, everyone believes the story? Anyone? That's crazy. That would never, no, it's a good story, right? And now we will extrapolate to the national economy. The economy is weak. People are unemployed. People want things. They want to go to work. We have things that people need done. We need to go on date nights. All we have to do is print money. Oh, that doesn't make any sense at all. That's crazy talk. Now we'll be in debt. And that's bad. Okay? The use of story in economics. People are telling you stories. And how can we decide if they are the good kind of story that we believe and that makes sense and will make our lives better as a community? Or how can we tell if they're the bad kind of story, which is snake oil? And we have a lot of those too. Okay? So that's the subject of today. Economists tell stories. Once upon a time, a farmer wanted to sell his pigs and he couldn't sell them, and then he lowered his price and then he sold all his pigs. And they extrapolate those stories to your situation and to our situation, to use it, right? Now, I skipped past my little intro because I was so enthusiastic about the story. And I left my book back in the room because I was reading it last night. The last 2 days, I have been talking about, and I've based most of my talk on a book called Sidewalks in the Kingdom, Christianity and New Urbanism. About the places that we build cities and how we get around in them and what they look like and what effect that has on our community. Today, and I highly recommend it, and eventually it will get to the bookstore. I go over there every day. They promised me it would be there, and it's not their fault. Apparently, the FedEx lost 56 pounds of Bibles recently. And the theory seems to be that people in Stehekin are really getting it. But I forgot the book that I'm preaching out of today, called If You're So Smart, The Narrative of Economic Expertise, which is all about how economists tell stories. And if we're smart, we will tell good stories. And if we're not smart or we're devious in some way, we'll tell bad stories. Donald McCloskey is the author, and for what it's worth, if you go looking for it, it's still published under Donald McCloskey, and I say still published under because he is now Deirdre McCloskey, and just a very interesting story on the side. But in any case, you can look for it under either name, it'll probably come up. And Donald said, these stories are not going to dry up the market for King Lear or the New Testament, but they are also stories that we should be familiar with and understand. I do have a lot of training in economics, although I don't wish to be called an economist. And the profession has been labeled the dismal science. Why has it been labeled the dismal science? Brings bad news? Well, a lot of people bring bad news.
Because it claims to limit what we can do as a society.
That is exactly right. It says there isn't enough. There is scarcity. It is the science of how we divvy up scarcity. It says, it talks about property rights, which is a word for, I have these benches and you don't get to have them. Okay? Anyone remember, is old enough to remember the zero-sum game? And raise your hand. Wild bestseller back in the day by the dean of the MIT School of Business, Buster Thoreau. So not a crazy guy. And who was in a zero-sum game here? Do you remember? Anyone? The U.S. and Japan were in a zero-sum game. If they're rich, we can't be rich. That's a bad story. But it sold millions of books. And again, McCloskey, a three-letter word, the economist's favorite word, but. A man had a bunch of pigs, and he thought he was rich, but. Then he couldn't have chickens because there was only so much food to go around. But, now in light of the story I told to open, is this a dismal science? Is this what economics is about? I like an economics that produces more, that produces something out of nothing, that helps us get along better. And that's a good chunk of economics. And I hope that we can read stories that claim that there isn't enough with a critic, and sometimes there isn't enough. There isn't. Alan's right. And I told him privately, I'll tell you publicly, I thanked him for saying what is in my heart, and figuring out a way to say what I want to say to a lot of my audiences without scaring the shit out of them, that we just have one hall, right? And we need to change what we're doing. So sometimes there isn't enough, but sometimes there is enough. And if we change the way we do business, if we change the way we organize our society, we can all have more. And this guy, MIT deanship or not, is wrong. He's totally wrong. And when people tell you isn't enough, you can argue back, I hope. So I told a story to open, which is a little bit like this. I don't know if everybody knows this cartoon. Math, then a miracle occurs. I told you a story. I tried to fill in then a miracle occurs, but do you think I did? Do you understand what happened, or do you think that was kind of magic? That was kind
of...
I'm sorry?
Don't understand.
You don't understand?
No.
Okay. Others?
Well, I think your
Paul?
Story illustrates that economics is a social science and not a natural science. That the processes depend on people and how people perceive reality and each other and mediate.
That's exactly right. Who listens to Car Talk? It's that kind of audience. Now, Car Talk is a very popular American public radio show.
Oh, even I've heard of it.
Oh, very good. Very good. Okay. So two mechanics, one of whom, they both happen to have gone to MIT, which is a common joke among them, and they said it was the best 16 years of their life. people call in with random questions about their cars, and they say, you know, actually, this is not a show about cars. This is a show about people. And cars are just a but that's what economics is, right? Now, what the problem with economics economists is that they would like you to think that they are natural scientists. We conducted an experiment, and it's replicable. You could start a babysitting cooperative in San Francisco, and it would behave just the same way. And you can scale it. Right? We're Newtonian. You bash two billiard balls into each other and they go boing, and you bash two planets into each other and they go boing. It's the same thing. We are scientists. You can move one story to another story and it behaves the same way, even though they're different people. They really want you to think that they're scientists, and then when they make pronouncements, when scientists make pronouncements, what do? They want us to believe them without further question, right? Now, unfortunately, a little aside, we're not, I think part of our problem is that we're not in fact paying attention to scientists. We aren't believing them without further question today, and there's a war on science. That's another course, and I think it's one that maybe Larry's teaching or something. But economists want that credibility, and they claim it, and they want you to believe that when they say, we actually understand what happens in here, right? And you should believe us and do what we tell you. The economy was sick, and we went to the doctor, not to Jesus. We went to Alan Greenspan, and he said, here's what you must do. You must do it. And we don't get to question Alan Greenspan. All right. So how can we distinguish good and true stories about economic magic or about how people behave when they're put in certain situations, economic situations, that are entirely, thank you, Paul, of their own making? Entirely of their own making. Okay, the babysitter cooperative, I left out one of the big things that economists love to talk about, natural resources. Well, we can take some of the natural resources. How many should we take at any one time? Do they reproduce? You know, are they renewable like trees? Are they non-renewable like copper? No natural resources. Most economic situations that we argue about, and certainly not all, because we're having an enormous argument about how fast to use our natural resources, okay? And that's another, but most human economics interactions are entirely human produced. So what are we going to do, and what stories are we going to tell ourselves about them? So an economic story is a story. So let's leave the economics out of it for starters and ask how you evaluate any other story that you hear. Do you believe stories that don't, that claim to not have morals? I was driving down the road, and then something happened and I crashed into you. It's not a moralistic story, it's just what happened, it's just the facts. Do you believe that? No, something happened. Someone was in the wrong most of the time, right? If you have children, I don't know what happened. there are stories that don't have oughts somewhere, either as a motivation, as the thing that happened, or as what's going to happen. Okay, mostly those are natural science stories. And even natural science stories often have morals, as we're finding out. But I would be very suspicious of that. A story that ends too soon is almost exactly the same thing. And economists love to say, I'm not telling you what to think about this. I'm just telling you that if we raise the minimum wage, fewer people will be employed. Because it's the law that when something costs more, labor, people use less of it. So if we increase the minimum wage, people will hire fewer workers. That's just economic law. It turns out actually not to be true. Okay? And I can tell you why if you want. And then finally, is the storyteller good company? And I really struggle with this one. Because this can really be misused. I struggle to have a good ethos and a good pathos. I struggle to tell you that I identify with you and that your troubles are my troubles, but they're not usually. Sometimes they are. We're all part of 1%. But the fact that the Capitol Hill Babysitter Cooperative works does not depend on whether I'm a good storyteller. Right? And the lesson remains whether or not I'm a good storyteller. The church has struggled with this in any number of ways. What if the pastor is bad? How does that color the message? That's a tough problem. But we are bombarded with so much economic advice and so many claims that the economy is like this, and so we should treat it like this, right? That A, we can't help but be influenced. We haven't gone to MIT, and thank God, because they're teaching data economics there. But we don't feel competent to evaluate all these economic stories. So we have to depend on some judgment of the storyteller. And this is how we end up in these camps. Over here, I'm a Keynesian. That was a Keynesian story that I told to begin with. We can print money and it'll be good. It's just a human invention. We can set up a new human invention with different amounts of stuff, and it will be good. And that puts me on the left. Okay? And when Paul Krugman, who is the country's leading Keynesian right now, and who I read everything that he writes, and I just think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, writes on, I believe him, whether I understand it with all my economics training or not. Paul says it, it's true. And over here, people have the exact opposite reaction to Paul Krugman. The exact opposite. And whatever Paul says, even if I previously thought it was true, healthcare, a single-payer healthcare or a national healthcare system would be a great idea if we set it up in this way. Mitt Romney set it up in Massachusetts, and now Paul Krugman thinks it's a great idea. But now, since Paul Krugman's in favor of it, I hate it. It's a terrible idea just because Paul's in favor of it. Now, I'm like that with a lot of people, too. I don't know what you're talking about exactly, but I know who you are. And if Rush Limbaugh thinks something's a good idea, man, I'm against it. It doesn't matter. And that's just the way it is, isn't it? I'm biased, but I have a short amount of day. I can't evaluate everything. I have to evaluate the messenger. So I encourage you to do that too, even though it's very problematic. Sometimes Rush is going to be right. Actually, somebody came to me after one of the other sessions and said, you know, you tell a good story about how cities support the whole human person, education, contact with other people, transportation, not everyone has to own their own car, you can share things, it's a great community. And the person said to me, the whole person needs to take care of his or her neighbor and not have the government do it for them. I live in a small town, and when my mother needs to go to the hospital and I can't take her, I don't tell her to take the bus. I find a friend to take her. That's a community. And I think that person has a point. That's a great point. Okay? And in cities, after we get past a certain size, that everyone taking somebody else's mother to the hospital doesn't work. Why? Because there are too many, even if we could do it, there are too many cars at the hospital. That's why the bus goes to the hospital. So the hospital can spend money on healthcare and not on a parking ramp, which is what most hospitals have to do these days. They have to be parking. You can see I don't care about it. I'm getting a little permission from Alan to be a little more passionate. See how I can transfer the blame? where was I? So evaluate the storyteller, okay? And just do it in a thoughtful, not knee-jerk way, okay? Oh, it's Paul, he's right. That's knee-jerk, and I shouldn't do it. Now let's move from general storytelling evaluation to specific economic storytelling evaluation. There are real scarcities, and that's the fact. That's heaven. That's reality, right? But there are a lot of claimed scarcities that are not real, that we just made up. And there's a school, I don't even know if they're right or left, they just are, called monetarism, that says that increasing the amount of money is really bad. Now, why is it really bad? Do I think they're totally crazy? Now they have a point. What is their point? It has less value. Exactly. And as soon as it costs, now that there's twice as much money on Capitol Hill for babysitting, somebody can say, I go to the person, I said, well, really, Pam and I haven't seen each other for months, we've got to go out. Here's, you know, are you free? Well, I might be free. I don't know. How much grip are you giving me? Well, one, that's the deal, right? Well, I could babysit for you, but I'd have to stop. I'd have to break this other commitment. I would be willing to do it for two. Right? Well, now I have twice as much money, but I'll give you two. That's fine. Now two is the new number. And now we're right back to where we started. We don't have more money. We have the same amount of money. The price has just doubled. So the monetarists aren't crazy. Now, Paul Krugman has an answer for that. which I think. But dollars are not artificially scarce. We make up the number of dollars. Okay? And so if a monetarist says to you, there's only so much money, they're wrong. They're just flat wrong. Okay? Or is an unexamined infinity assumed? And this is the flip side, right? We're never going to run out of trees. That's crazy talk. And you can go back to the primary sources from the 1800s in Minnesota, and it wasn't an implicit assumption. It was absolutely explicit. We are not going to run out of trees. Okay? The idea of setting aside some of it for a state park, or, you know, the only reason we have the towering white pines at Lake Itasca is what?
Somebody's
mother. No. Even funnier than that. It was a surveying error.
Oh, right.
So, you know, the map, they didn't line up, and, you know, I mean, for better or worse, the timber barons were, they were good capitalists in the sense that they obeyed the rules as they existed. You can have this square to log, and then you have this square, and you have this square, and the squares didn't line up. And what's left is Lake Itasca. Stay part of the Tower of Pines, so we get to see it. Absolutely true. People at work. Examine the claim of infinity. And that applies especially on the natural resource side of economics. But It also applies to just human resources. There are only so many hours. There are only so many people to go around. There's only so much labor. And then finally, I talked about is the law being appealed to real. So the law of supply and demand says that if you increase the minimum wage, then fewer people will be hired. So going into science economist mode, scientists studied what happened. So once upon a time, New Jersey had a $5 minimum wage, and then something happened. The minimum wage law was raised to $7. And what happened? The unemployment rate went down. Why? People had more money to spend. It's a human construct. Okay, there's no natural law like there is that only two hydrogen atoms can bond to an oxygen atom. That's a law. How people will behave, how an economy, how a community will behave in the presence of different kind of wages is a human construct. And then finally, watch out for the words. In my other days teaching, I talk about transportation a lot, and highway engineers love to talk about improvements. We're going to improve your highway. 90% of the time, what this means is they're going to cut down the trees, they're going to take some of your land to widen the highway, they're going to take out that hill that was attractive, and everyone's going to be able to go through your neighborhood a lot faster. Maybe it's an improvement for the people trying to get from point A to point C, but you're at point B, and it's not an improvement for you. It's a change, and now it's better for some people and worse for you. So it's a change, but it is not an improvement. Who has had the experience of going off to college or any course, really, at any time of life, and you discover new ideas, and you're really excited about them. Now you can only talk about those things. And I came home and I said, have you ever, and I was talking to my parents, and I said, Vilfredo Pareto was an Italian economist, and now we talk about Pareto improvements, because Pareto said that an improvement is something that makes at least one person better off while not making anybody else worse off. That's a Pareto improvement, and that's a very special thing, type of improvement, right? Mom says, that should be the only thing that's called an improvement. What are you
Points.
Right. But most economists, when they talk about an improvement, mean that things get 10 better. Or if they're Spinal Tap economists, they get one louder. Right? But if one person is 5 worse and the other person is 15 better, it's still 10 better. And those guys can work out a deal. The 15 guy can give the 5 guy 5, and then everyone will be better off, right? And it doesn't matter who you give the property rights to, they'll work something out. Okay? That's the Coase theorem, that it doesn't matter, the price will be the same no matter who you give the property right to.
If your guy with 15 puts 5 of them in the Cayman Islands.
Exactly. Now, Coase gets a bad name because he said as an economic law it doesn't matter, as a social matter it matters. That's the whole game, right? That's the whole game, is who gets the property right. And the economists just pick up the first half and go, that's really interesting. It doesn't matter who you give the property rights to because they'll work something out. That's really interesting, and it is really interesting, right? The beginning position doesn't matter under a lot of circumstances in terms of setting the ultimate price. But who ends up richer, who gets the price, that matters. So be careful when they say improve. These are the two big ones to watch out for. What are some other words that seem problematic to you in economics talk?
Free.
Free. Oh, yeah. Free parking. It's free? Does it appear from nowhere? No, we spend a lot of money building those parking garages at hospitals. But they're given away for free. And that warps a lot of stuff. Warps a lot of stuff.
What's the actual cost per space?
Surface spaces are about $12,000 to 20, depending on the value of the land underneath them, obviously, structured spaces. Elevated structure, $25,000-$30,000 a space. Underground structures, $50,000-$60,000 per space. Our cars are living better than we are. A lot better. And by law, you must provide for the car. You can't build something unless you provide for the car. We're not going to give you that building permit. You haven't provided for the car. But try and require that if you build an expensive condo, you are required to build a cheap condo for somebody else. Oh, that's outrageous. No, but we're taking care of the cars. So that's my big lecture on economics and stories and what you should watch out for when someone says, I'm an economist and I'm here to help you. but I promised to talk about cities and about choices. That was the advertising that I'd like to make good on that. So economics is, of course, part of the art of making choices. Another place where economists will get us into trouble is when they claim or we believe that the economics of a choice is the only part of the choice. Well, it's more efficient economically, therefore that's the whole game. I'm not in favor of inefficiency, but you have to examine it. So let's talk about some city stories in the context of economics. Sprawl is the result of the market working. Big roads are more efficient. Big boxes are more efficient. Let's have a quiz. So how are you going to evaluate these stories? They're not really actually in a story form yet, are they? They're claims that you would like to be, like, that people would like to have you believe. The first step to evaluating these maybe is to start putting them in story form. So let's do that. Someone want to put the sprawl in story form for me? Tom.
I would like to build my housing development.
Nope, start with once upon a time.
Once upon a time, I had people who wanted to live in larger lots in a more sylvan environment.
Okay.
So I'm proposing to build this housing development.
And then remember, the story says, and then.
I can't afford to do it here. I have to do it over there because it's land is cheap.
Okay. And then I built it. I found the cheap land. And I built it.
You as a society to build me a road so that my people.
Well, you're trying to tell a broader. I want a very simple story. I'm sorry. I'm a tough grader, Tom.
And
then okay. The houses became too expensive for the people to buy.
Well, okay. So everyone wants to do exactly what I told you to do, which is to play the story out. I just want the simple. The economist is telling a story in defense of sprawl. Tell me a very short 1-2-3 story that Paul.
Once upon a time, Golden Village had too many guests. And so they built condos out on the Heart Lake Trail. And
everybody was happy.
And the market
it was good.
Okay.
And then Golden Village did great.
Yeah.
And then they were happy.
But they needed a store.
Okay, well, this is why I don't teach as a profession. And literally, because I do this professionally, although I teach it, obviously, this is what I hear. Once upon a time, there was a city, like the one we all grew up in, many of us grew up in, downtown neighborhoods. And remember what the implication is here? The sprawl is a result of the market working. So before that, we didn't have sprawl, right? So apparently the market wasn't working yet. And then we loosened things up so that the market could work and everything could become more efficient. And then as a result, right, it's an explanatory story. Well, how did we get sprawl, Mr. Economist? Well, that's the market at work. Well, that the implied story is this, right? And so go back, use the action to evaluate the implied premise. The premise must be that beforehand the market wasn't working. Now, the person telling this story would say, no, you're misinterpreting me horribly. A lot of other things happened. Tastes changed. Gas got cheap.
Cars got cheap.
Exactly. So there are a lot of ways to tell this story, and I'm telling it in the least fair possible way. But quite seriously, this is the basic story. When people say that's the result of the market working, they must imply that before the market wasn't working. And maybe some other things are in play as well. Do you think that's right? Was the market not working before when we had a downturn? Okay, so who was here on day one? So what actually happened in economic terms that explains sprawl? Rachel?
I don't know if this is economic terms, but I think that the tire companies and the gas companies took the streetcar lines out and made roads, and they're all covered up now.
General Motors did, in fact, and there's a lot of debate about if this is urban myth or not, but the truth is, General Motors was, in fact, tried and convicted of monopoly behavior for buying up streetcar lines and shutting them down so that people would drive. Okay. That's really just a small part of the story. We have zoning that prevents us from building the neighborhoods that we grew up on. The lots are now in a lot of cities, and I don't mean to be too blanket about this, but in most cities, in fact, there are minimum lot sizes. So if you want to simplify and build a smaller house or build two houses on the space of one, if you want two people on one bench, it's illegal. Even if you think you can make more money, I want to be a good capitalist and build two houses and make $200,000 rather than build one house and make $160,000. The market would like to give me more money, but it's illegal. I can't do it. Zoning. Two. We fund only certain kinds of transportation. We build roads. There's a lot of money for roads and regulations that say I can build a road here with no second guessing. But if you want to build a transit line, you have to go out and hold bank sales. Okay, so there's laws, there's money. And the third is that you must take care of your cars. You must build them parking. You can't decide as a developer, as a capitalist, how much parking am I going to provide. You can't decide what the market wants in terms of parking. We've already made that decision for you. You have to build so many parking spaces. That's a long way of saying that the market is?
Not working.
Not working. Excellent. Excellent. Very good. Gold star. We have made the market less free. This is the exact opposite of the truth. It's still an economic story, right? And economics, the reason that I like economics, and I sometimes wonder why I do, because it's kind of a crazy thing, I'd actually rather be studying alpine wildflowers, to be completely honest with you, but I seem to be good. Anyway, it helps us understand what's going on. And without economics, with this special form of knowledge that people, some of whom are crazy, and some of whom are bad storytellers and do not have our best interests at heart, but they've done some interesting science and we can understand the world a little better through this lens. And without the lens, we're left with people are bad. They want bad things. They're moving out to the suburbs because they don't care about the city. They drive all these cars not because we have made it cheap for them to drive cars and we've given them free parking spaces to put the cars on at every conceivable place where they live in the car without their ever having to pay for it. They're bad people because they drive so much. I don't like that story, and I don't think it's true. I don't think it's true. I think if we change the prices, if we change the regulations, then people choose in freedom to do different things. And yesterday and on Monday, we talked about what happens when you change the market. People do, in fact, behave differently, and I like to think that they're happier, and an economist would say, you don't get to choose whether people are happy. I say, by your own science, people are happier because they're doing it. If you change the market and make it more free, if people get to choose smaller houses, if they get to not drive as much, if they don't have to pay for parking if they're given a choice to pay for parking or not, right? So at work, I get to either rent a parking space or not. And some of my colleagues choose to rent the parking space, and some, like myself, take the bus. We have a choice. But if I have to pay, if I get the parking space taken out of my paycheck, I'm going to use it. Everybody getting free parking at work is like giving you free gas. Now, if you get free gas, are you going to use it? Are you going to drive to work every day? Sure. Does that make you a bad person? Yeah.
Does your employer also, if you have a paid parking place, do they give you a paid bus pass?
In one of my previous lives, I tried very hard. I lived on Capitol Hill, and I tried to make it a condition of getting, and that not only do you have to, but so you have to provide the parking space in a lot of cases, but you can also write it off as a business expense, okay? And the change that we wanted to make was, if you provide free parking, in order to get a write-off for it, you must also offer the choice of a bus pass.
Yeah.
That is a long story, and we sort of won. It's long, but I'm happy to tell it. But again, that's a human construct. How are we going to deal with these? How are we going to require people to do X, Y, Z, right? But I like economics because it tells this can go too far as well. The Austrian school of economics is like, only economic man is the good man, because only in free exchange are we treating each other like adults, and only through understanding economic exchange and cutting deals with each other can we understand the good life and freedom, etc. There's a whole story. I think that goes too far. There are other stories to be told about how we should get along, and I believe those more. But it's an interesting lens to look at the world through, and I kind of like it. And I encourage you to do that as well. So I'm going to try and wrap up, and then I haven't really left enough time for everything I wanted to say today. But some other ways to interrogate, and I really like Ellen's word, interrogate the story here. So, watch for claims of free markets, because very, very few markets are actually free. We've fettered them to a fairly well, which I'm mostly in favor of, but they're not free. Okay, there are all kinds of conditions in the theoretical perfect market. How do we know we have a perfect market? Well, everyone has information. Does everyone have information? You have to be free to trade. Is everyone free to trade? No, I can't build two houses. I can't hire you to build two houses on my lot. It's illegal. I'm not free to trade. So just watch for free claims of free markets. We didn't really talk about efficiency at what yet, but just ask the question, at what? Efficiency has a goal, and it's not an end in itself. So ask efficient at what or what for. And then efficiency comes from someplace. It comes from doing something, more of something with less input. Right, that's the economic definition of efficiency. Well, what's the less input? Is it less people? Is it less labor? Is it more stuff? It's more efficient. Now, we used to wash clothes by hand, and now we do it with tons of water. Right, so we traded one input for another, and it's more efficient because we're using less labor. We're using a lot less labor. No one really wants to go back to washing clothes in the stream, but the efficiency came from someplace, and we better understand where it comes from. So efficiency. What? So, and check that obviously against the gospel or whatever your guiding points are. But the economic choices have moral implications, and the efficiency is, and I'll give the efficiency gurus their due. I would rather not waste resources, and part of the problem is that we waste a lot. Just interrogate the claim. I was really excited about that, but I'm just going to skip it. Economists like to claim that if we just do what they say, we can have it all. Be efficient, and I can, tell you economics, it would be sort of a fun thing that I'll give you, you can have it all stories, and you can test me. And in some cases, or you can test yourself those stories, in some cases I think it's true. There's good magic, and in some cases they're false. It's bad magic and it's snake oil. So I wish that I could tell you that there's no free lunch, because that would be easy. And it's an attractive view of the world because it's simple and it purports to lay out an easy to apply rule. And so when Paul Krugman says, there is a free lunch, There's a $500 bill lying on the ground. And the guy reaches, says, no, there are not $500 bills lying on the ground. There just aren't. And I think there are free lunches to be had, but at the same time, you should be very wary of Paul Krugman or anybody else telling you that there is magic and there is a free lunch, and if we just did it this way, without working, without repentance, without giving something up, that it will be okay. Because that's not true either. So it's a tough one. And beware of simple claims, I guess, in any kind of storytelling. And watch for the metaphor and the analogy. So 10 minutes left. What do you think? Let's have a conversation. Interrogate my story.
Could you put up the previous slide just so we can see what you were excited about?
Well, this is a whole, you know, and so, and Alan, I don't mean to lean entirely. I'm just so taken with your talk this morning. So, Alan said, you know, the economy's ailing, let's go to the doctor. And we talk a lot about this, and I feel. I was excited because I was looking forward to having a conversation about whether that's the right way, if that's a good way or a bad way to talk about the economy, okay? And I was reading a very challenging piece recently on this very subject and the role of language and how we think about the economy. And the difficulty of making the economy this impersonal thing that's just going to do what it's going to do. And that can, on the one hand, if you make it this impersonal thing that just does what it does, it sort of says hands off,
yeah.
Right? And it's not a human construct. And so this article really wanted to say, no, bankers took risks with our money and screwed things up. And incidentally, when you read it, I just want to leave you with some rules, not just it's tough. If it's exciting, it's not banking. Okay. So, people lost their jobs. People made decisions, and then other people lost their jobs. But I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The economy is a thing. The Capitol Hill Babysitters Collaborative was a thing. It was an economy, and the economy makes certain demands. Okay, now when the market makes certain, well, we have to do it because it's good for the market, right? That's serving mammon. It's not serving God, okay? But I think it is okay to talk about making the economy better. Yes?
But isn't there another dimension here that not only renders us passive?
Right.
But right. And I think most any time you say the instead of the, and capitalize now.
Yep. I did that intentionally.
You're close to idolatry.
I think that's exactly right.
So it renders us passive in the way that idols demand action and sacrifice.
That's exactly right. And thank you, Larry, so what is Greece demanding, or what is Germany demanding of Greece right now?
Sacrifice.
Yeah. The economy demands sacrifice. Yeah.
I only barely understand all of this. But the one thing that I'm surprised hasn't come up in this, because it dominates the media, is the role of taxes, which strike me as like something tied into a whole other system.
Yep.
And the economy, because it seems like the conversation we have over the dinner table is about, when we talk about the economy, it automatically goes to taxes, at least in my family, in the circles that I move in. And cities are saying, well, we can't increase taxes because that will drive business away, and
you
know, and then people will lose jobs.
Right.
I realize that's probably like a whole other thing, but
yeah.
If you could like sum up in the taxes for idiots.
Wow.
There's a book opportunity there.
There really is. Thank you for that question. Taxes are the price that we pay to have things that we want. And they cost a certain amount of money. and how they are levied makes an enormous difference in how the economy works. Because, and I'll just, you know, just, I'll stand on the left side here just to be honest, but I'll tell you another story, okay? Once upon a time, we taxed income, and we didn't really tax pollution very much. We regulated pollution. We said you can only put so much out, but we didn't tax it. And what did we get? And then, because one thing was taxed and made it more expensive, and the other thing was not taxed, which made it cheaper, we had less income, we had less labor, and we had more pollution. Now, the economist would say, any economist who, regardless of what's right there, will tell you, and there's some things they agree on, is that, in fact, even though I just impugned this law when I talked about the minimum wage in New Jersey, in fact, most of the time, when something gets more expensive, there's less of it, okay? And so, once upon a time, Germany did this, and then they lowered the taxes on employees, on income, and they raised the taxes on pollution, and they got less pollution, and they got more employment. Mm-hmm. And the same amount of taxes. So that was good. And then people were happier. And so that was a good story. Now, other economists will say, that's not the end of the story. The pollution makers went to another country which had lower pollution taxes. Yeah, you got to spit it all out. Okay? But taxes for idiots. It matters what you put them on. It matters who you put them on. Because we're probably going to tax income some. So does it, you put it on the rich or do you put it on the poor? Now, economics has something to say about what will happen, depending on who you put it on. The church will have something to say about which one you should put it on. Those will inform each other. When people on the left say we should only tax corporations and not people, in fact, that's another human construct. Corporations will probably just raise their prices and pass a chunk of it on to people. Taxes don't come from nowhere, so we have to understand where they come from, right? And the science of economics will tell you under what conditions how much of the new tax the corporation will be able to pass on to the consumer, okay? Which is actually pretty interesting. It's not always the same answer. Conditions change, they change. And that's sort of an interesting question if you're an economist. But it's also an interesting question if you're a church trying to figure out where you say we should put the tax, because where you put it matters. I'm not really answering your question. I think that economics says that there is never, empirical economics says that no society that and tax policy helps create, it's not the only thing, but it helps create equality or inequality. No society with our level of inequality survives. So taxes for idiots, if we keep doing this, we're not going to survive in our current. So defending the American way of life, it's going to go away. Okay? If we continue our current tax policy, that's it. Maybe your answer or not. But
maybe a quick question. Is there any evidence that the current tax reduction for the rich is actually creating jobs?
No.
No.
Maybe a few. Maybe a few. Yes, Cheryl.
I was just going to comment. It's interesting you talk about story and social economics as social science. I just picked up this Newsweek in the library here. It's the most recent issue of Newsweek, and one of the primary feature stories is entitled "Generation Screwed," and it's about how the boomers have screwed the millennials economically by being self-absorbed, self-indulgent. Letting debt run wild. There's nothing about corporations or government. It's all about the individual. And then now having to stay in the workforce longer to take care of their own bad behavior economically, and how this is going to has led to an interruption of the American dream for this generation of young people, that they will never have as good a life as their parents did, that they will possibly a majority will not own their own homes, that they will be forced to live in places they don't want to live, that they are overeducated and underemployed chronically, not just now, but for a lifetime. And so there's this, it's a very interesting story that has a whole lot of you know, values infused in it around that the what is seen as bad behavior and sort of reaping what we sow, and is also seen as forced deprivation of this generation of people. That there's, so there's this kind of poor me tone where they've interviewed all these 20-somethings in here, and there's this definite point of view of the article which is poor me, poor me, because I don't get to be middle class, or I'll never be middle class. And so it just, I think when we talk about it, going back to Alan's point of view, is stepping back and thinking of the whole 7 billion and how this is just a perpetuation of what we deserve, you know, whether you're 20 or 60 or somewhere in between. And it's a fascinating story and a great example of this as social science, not as natural law. So I'll put this back in the library.
So you're saying, Cheryl, that if one person has something, another person can have it as well? That
sounds
crazy.
Well, that's all. If we breathe the same air, we should be able to get it, right? If we were born into a white middle-class family, we're entitled to that for life.
It's noon, and I don't want to keep you after class, but I'm happy to stay after class. And we can stay here for a while. You can also find me at lunch or another time. So. Thank you for your attention.